Folks, have you checked out the Irish History Podcast shop recently? Right now, I have a sale of 30% off everything when you use the code SALE30. So go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and get 30% off everything when you use the discount code SALE30.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer and this is episode 17, The Return of the O'Briens. Back in episode 14, the last show on medieval Ireland, we looked at the life of the remarkable King of Leinster, Diarmaid Muchmuil na Mó, and how he forced his way into a position of power. Today we continue our journey through medieval Ireland in the 11th century, following the return to power of Brian Boru's descendants, who all bore his name in their surname, O'Brien. Their return to power sparked what became a real-life Game of Thrones between the kings of the five medieval provinces of Ireland, Munster, Leinster, Meath, Ulster and Connacht. The final years of the life of Diarmaid Muchmuil na Mó, that great king of Leinster, were difficult. From comparatively humble origins, the ageing King Diarmaid had transformed his family fortunes, rising to one of the most powerful kings in Ireland in the early 11th century. At his height, he could make or break other kings, most famously illustrated when he installed Thurlough O'Brien as King of Munster in 1064. But in 1070, things had declined rapidly. His son Murchad, the man Diarmaid had been grooming as his successor, died in Dublin. A year later, tragedy struck again when another of his sons, Glunearing, was killed in battle north of Dublin. While he did have other children, Murchad and Glunearing were clearly his favourites, and in their absence he was politically isolated. Vulnerable and ageing, a crisis loomed for Diarmaid, as there was no clear heir to succeed him. Predictably, the domestic dispute of a generation broke out as Diarmaid's relatives began jockeying for position. And in 1071, his brother, Donald, and his grandsons went to war, aiming to position themselves to succeed Diarmaid. All the king himself could do was watch as his relations squabbled. He himself was powerless to act. And in the end, he had to endure the ignominy of calling on his ally, Thurlough O'Brien, the king of Munster, who he had installed in 1064, to intervene on his behalf. Thurlough was more than happy to act, and he thundered into Leinster, taking hostages from the various factions, and handed them over to Diarmaid, re-establishing his authority. As Thurlough handed the hostages to Diarmaid, though, the power shift was evident for all to see. Like sand in an hourglass, the position of Ireland's most powerful king was clearly ebbing from Diarmaid in Leinster to Thurlough in Munster. Ironically, it had been Diarmaid who had raised Thurlough up. He had supported him against his uncle Donacha and installed him as King of Munster in 1064. But how the tables had turned. In the short term, in 1071, while Diarmaid may have been grateful he had such a powerful ally to call upon, he also must have known Thurlough was not doing this out of the goodness of his heart. Indeed, Thurlough himself was looking to the future. He too was jockeying for position and looking to a world without Diarmaid, one he wished to dominate. Thurlough would not have to wait long to cash in on helping Diarmaid stay in power. On February the 7th, 1072, the aging king went on campaign in Meath, no doubt hoping to re-establish himself. However, his time was up, and at the Battle of Odba, Diarmaid was killed. In the fast-changing world of medieval Ireland, there was little time for sentimentality or mourning over his death. There was power up for grabs. While some of his family would unquestionably succeed Diarmaid as King of Leinster, Thurlough O'Brien was thinking of the bigger picture and who would be the most powerful king on the island now that Diarmaid was dead. For Thurlough, he needed to act quickly to establish his authority. Wasting no time, he gathered an army and moved east, invading southern Leinster, Diarmaid's home territory. Despite being Diarmaid's ally, he ransacked the land, burned crops and took cattle. Diarmaid's brother Donal, known as Donal the Fat, had emerged as the family patriarch, but was in no position to resist Thurlough. Indeed, he had to hand over his sons as hostages to ensure his loyalty and subordination. Thurlough had got off to a great start, and next he moved north to the all-important settlement of Dublin. With its close contacts across the Irish Sea, the city provided its ruler with wealth and importantly access to a growing region around the Irish Sea, which included the Isle of Man, a strategically important island between Ireland and Britain. Arriving at the city of Dublin, he faced no opposition, and the city rulers too submitted to him. When he returned to his home in Thomond, in the north of the Kingdom of Munster, he finished a year of consolidation by eliminating internal opposition by blinding his kinsman, Cunning, thereby removing any aspirations he may have had on power. By the end of 1072, Thurlough must have been very satisfied. He had handled the transition of power after Diarmaid's death very well. Of course, outside Munster, there were still many who had not submitted to him, but they were unlikely to put up much of a fight. The Kingdom of Meath, north of Dublin, could be troublesome, but its rulers were now a pale shadow of their ancestors who had once been high kings. Meanwhile, in the west, the Kingdom of Connacht was internally divided between the O'Connors, the O'Rourkes and the O'Flahertys, each vying for control, but none able to emerge dominant. Finally, in Ulster, the great power of the north, the Cineallóin, who had provided numerous high kings, were at their lowest ebb since emerging as a major power in the 8th century. The two branches of the family, the McLaughlins and the O'Neills, were tearing each other apart, battling for control in a struggle that would last 3 decades. It was clear that surrounded by divided kingdoms, Thurlough will quickly mop up opposition. In 1073, Thurlough attacked Meath, taking advantage of internal conflict. He was able to bring them to heel, easily leaving him enough time that year to cross the Shannon into Connacht, where he took hostages. Arriving back in Thomond, Thurlough had huge wealth and one of the most bizarre war trophies, the head of the former King of Meath, who had been killed by his own kingsmen. While seeming strange, presumably Thurlough's possession of the head symbolised his dominance over Meath. But on this occasion, carrying around a dead man's head had serious implications for Thurlough. According to the annals of the Four Masters, when the head was presented to him, a mouse emerged and bit him. He contracted an unknown illness which made his hair fall out, and although he did survive, he never truly recovered from this bizarre incident. While Thurlough struggled with this mysterious illness, his armies were busy expanding his power. Having taken Dublin in 1072, they now had access to the trading and political allies of the city, and in particular, the Isle of Man. The relationship between Dublin and the Isle of Man during this period was particularly close, and the rulers of each region looked to dominate the other. This will explain how some of Thurlough's kinsmen died fighting in the Isle of Man in 1073. Now, despite his sickness, Thurlough can only have been content. To say Ireland had fallen on his lap might be an overstatement, but some of the most powerful kings in Irish history had spent decades achieving what Thurlach had done in the space of 1 year. Thurlach himself was clearly talented, but he'd also benefited from the fact that he had emerged in an era when the other kingdoms around him were internally very divided. However, while Thurlach had an easier rise to power in Ireland, he did have to deal with a new issue the great high kings of the past would not have understood. That is, the Normans. In 1066, the Normans from northern France had invaded England. In Ireland, Diarmaid MacMuireann na mBoe, the most powerful king at the time, had adopted a hostile attitude, supporting the sons of the Anglo-Saxon king Harald. But by Thurlach's reign, things had changed. The Normans were no longer trying to conquer England by the 1070s. By then, they had annihilated all opposition and were unquestionably the rulers from the English Channel in the south to the Welsh borders to Scotland in the north. They had established a new power in the Irish Sea region, and as Thurlach's influence and power grew through his connections in Dublin, he now had to decide how he would deal with the new reality of Norman England. Now, while the eminent historian Sean Duffy has argued Thurlach had an adversarial relationship with the Normans, Benjamin Hudson has pointed out that this may not have been the case. This can be seen in 1075, when a group of Norman and Danish earls in England rose up against the Norman king, William the Conqueror. Although details are scant, it is unusual that these rebels were dependent on support arriving from Denmark, given that Ireland, and in particular Dublin, was frequently a source of mercenaries across Britain. The plot thickens when in 1075 we also find Thurlach deposing the Norse king of Dublin, Godfrey, and by the end of the year installing his own son, Murkertach, as king of the city. Benjamin Hudson has convincingly argued that this may have been because the Norse in Dublin were readying themselves for intervention in the revolt in England, something that would not have gone down well with William the Conqueror. We should not assume that during this period it was fear of a Norman invasion that would have made Thurlach react in such a manner. During this period, trade between the ports of Waterford and Dublin and ports in England such as Bristol grew. In this context, the Viking king of Dublin, Godfrey's desire to go to war on a whim in England could have been disastrous. Indeed, it's likely he was more worried that such an intervention would affect his trading relationship with William. Thurlach seems to have had an all-round positive relationship with the Normans, which was illustrated through his frequent contact with Lanfranc, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and close aide of William the Conqueror. By the late 1070s, Thurlach had unquestionably emerged as the most powerful monarch in Ireland. However, by the end of the decade, murmurings of a serious revolt were emanating from the Kingdom of Connacht. Next, we will head across to Shannon and see the rise of the Kingdom of Connacht.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Recently, I had a minor argument with a close friend that brought up things from my past that I really needed to get off my chest. I think we've all been there. Now, I found therapy a really great way to work through these issues. For me, I really like online therapy, and BetterHelp is a really great online service that allows you to make space for therapy no matter how busy you are. BetterHelp is convenient, affordable, and gives you the support you need, but also works around your schedule. It's really easy to get up and running with a therapist on BetterHelp. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. You can do your sessions by text, phone, or video call, whichever suits you best. It's all about flexibility, working around your schedule. At the moment, BetterHelp are offering listeners to the show 10% off their first month. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Irish History today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Irish History. The province and corresponding early medieval kingdom of Connacht was among the most remote places in medieval Ireland. Generally speaking, Connacht is compromised of all land to the west of the River Shannon, except County Clare. In the medieval period, the kings of Connacht had long been subordinate to the kings of Munster or the O'Neills in the north, but by the 11th century they were beginning to emerge as a power in their own right. And this presented a major threat to Thurlough. Despite their rise in power, Thurlough had been able to use divisions in Connacht between the powerful families of the O'Connors, the O'Flahertys and the O'Rourkes in the province to neuter opposition. But this was always an uphill battle, given their constant squabbling. In 1079, A.O. Flaherty was killed by Rory O'Connor. Thurlough needed to react to stop Rory rising to power. In a preemptive move on his part, he invaded Connacht and expelled Rory O'Connor from the province. However, this in turn cleared the path for the rise of the O'Rourkes, and by the early 1080s, Thurlough had failed to stop the rise of Dunnacha O'Rourke, and in 1084, Dunnacha had cast aside centuries of history that had seen his family, and indeed the wider Connacht region, play second fiddle to Munster and Ulster. He led his army into the east of Ireland to attack Leinster, hoping to prise the kingdom from Thurlough's dominance, thereby establishing himself as a major power. As he moved across the Shannon, he turned south to the River Liffey, which in the medieval period formed the northern border of Leinster. They crossed the Liffey at the settlement of Leixlip, which had been founded centuries earlier by the Norse Vikings. It was here that those same Norse, led by Sitric Caoch, had gone a long way to establishing the Vikings as a permanent presence in Dublin when they had defeated the King of Leinster in 917. Politics, though, in Ireland had changed much in the following century and a half. And now in 1084, Dunnacha O'Rourke was hoping to emulate an equally seismic shift by bringing Connacht centre stage in Gaelic Ireland. At Leixlip, Dunnacha O'Rourke faced down Scandinavians who were fighting for their Gaelic overlord Thurlough, alongside his army drawn from Munster and Leinster. Thurlough did not lead the army. He was well into his 70s at this stage and in poor health. This honour fell to his son Muirchertach, who had been the King of Dublin for nearly a decade and acting overlord of Leinster. While the power of Connacht was unquestionably rising, Dunnacha still was no match for such a force, and as the red mist of blood and broken bone descended over Leixlip, his army was routed and Dunnacha was killed. If death wasn't enough, Dunnacha had to suffer further humiliation, and he was decapitated and his head taken to Thurlough at Limerick as a trophy of war. One would think Thurlough would have learned from his experience with the mouse 11 years earlier when he'd been struck down when presented with another defeated king's head. Indeed, this bizarre illness he had contracted from the head of the King of Meath in 1073 haunted him for the rest of his life. By 1086, the 77-year-old Thurlough was in the throes of death as the illness returned. Finally, on the day before the Ides of July, the 14th of the month, he died. The annals of the Four Masters tell us that he never really recovered from that bizarre illness he contracted in 1073. Thurlough O'Brien had been an impressive king. During his rule, Ireland had been relatively peaceful. He had been able to benefit from the fact that the surrounding kingdoms were weak and divided. During his reign, the only major challenge was that of Dunnacha O'Rourke from Connacht, which his son Muirchertach, the King of Dublin, had dealt with easily. I use the term relatively peaceful because people who lived in Ulster knew nothing of the stability of Thurlough's reign, The province was ravaged by war during these years. The traditional power of the north, the Canale Own, were unable to establish control as they were divided by a civil war. Other powers in the province, particularly the Ullidh in East Ulster, had attempted to take advantage of this situation. It was not until 1084, after 30 years of chaos, that Donal MacLachlan finally rose to power among the Canale Own and began establishing stability. Nonetheless, during Turlough's reign, the province had not known peace. However, after Turlough's death, this lack of peace would become infectious as a fierce struggle soon opened up to succeed him. In the post-Turlough world, there was little doubt who was the front-runner to succeed him. His son, Murchatach, had ruled Dublin since 1075 and had established himself as de facto overlord of the province of Leinster. Unfortunately for Murchatach, many in his family, and indeed rival kings across Ireland, were unwilling to accept his rule. While his brother Tadhg died 4 weeks after his father, Murchatach was immediately opposed as king by his other brother, Diarmaid, and his dead brother Tadhg's sons. In what was an unusual moment of humanity in medieval Ireland, Murchatach did not kill his brother, who had challenged him. Instead, he exiled him from Munster to rule the Viking city of Waterford. But this ability to ruthlessly deal with Diarmaid would haunt Murchatach for the rest of his life. While he was attempting to control his family, kingdoms across Ireland, dominated by Murchatach's father Turlough, now saw their chance to break free from the domination of the kings of Munster. In 1086, in the aftermath of Turlough's death, the king of Meath, Muil Seachnal, led an invasion of Dublin and Leinster. In this act, he was declaring himself independent by attempting to dominate another kingdom which had submitted to Turlough. Now, way back in the 9th and 10th century, the Kingdom of Meath had provided several high kings, and Dublin and Leinster had once been in their sphere of influence. But times had changed, however, and the new King of Meath, Muil Seachnal, learned this in a bloody lesson when he was repelled from Leinster at the Battle of Bracha Cruinneach. Having defeated Meath, the King of Leinster now formed an alliance with Murchatach's exiled brother Diarmaid, based in the port of Waterford. In 1087, they launched an audacious attack. Ground forces from Leinster attacked eastern Munster, while Diarmaid led a marine assault, landing in Murchatach's rear in the southwest. However, they underestimated the young king's power, and he was able to defeat both armies. Nevertheless, the fabric that had bound Turlough O'Brien's kingdom together was beginning to unravel for his son. To his north, Murchatach could see a storm brewing in Connacht. In 1086, while several conflicts raged across Ireland and Murchatach was distracted, the situation in Connacht altered decisively. On the battlefield, Rory O'Connor killed Eo O'Rourke and established the dominance of the O'Connors in the province for the coming decade. Murchatach had to act, but the situation was complicated. Unquestionably, the rise of the O'Connors was the greatest threat to his power, but his sister Moore had married Rory O'Connor, while Murchatach himself had married Dúchlavaig, the sister of Rory. This obviously added an extra dimension to Murchatach's deliberations on what to do, and he simply didn't act in 1086. However, across Ireland, people must have feared the worst in 1087, when disaster struck when both Moore and Dúchlavaig died. These deaths transformed the situation. The shackles were off. Murchatach now began to plan what was going to become an enormous naval invasion of Connacht. The strategy was bold. He was planning to catch the O'Connors in a giant pincer movement. One force would sail up the Shannon River, which formed the eastern border of Connacht. Meanwhile, over 100 miles to the west, another force would take to the Atlantic Ocean, sailing up the west coast of Ireland and land on O'Connor's western flank. In planning this attack, Murchatach must have known this would be one of the largest and strategically most complicated attacks in Irish history. Just think of the logistics of how this would work. There was no way the two armies could keep in contact once they left Munster. Should any calamity befall one army, the other would not know. These dangers aside, Murchatach pressed on. He was under pressure. He needed to forcibly bring Connacht down a notch or two. However, he was facing a very serious foe in Rory, who was anticipating Muirchertach's attack. Now, Rory himself didn't have a strong fleet. This was a hangover from the fact that the Vikings had never established a major trading port on the isolated west coast. So rather than challenge Muirchertach on the river, a fight he would almost certainly lose, Rory adopted a clever, innovative defensive strategy. As the Shannon meanders across the plains of the Midlands on the Tipperary-Offaly border near the town of Banagher, the river divides into narrow channels either side of Inishsherky Island. Here Rory decided he would make his stand. He occupied the island from where he could easily destroy any fleet attempting to move north up the River Shannon. For Muirchertach, he had to clear this garrison before he could move forward, but he was at a distinct disadvantage against forces who had much greater mobility on land. In an ensuing battle in the narrow channels around Inishsherky, Rory emerged victorious. After the defeat, in an age of limited communication, a very serious situation developed for Muirchertach. As the eastern arm of his pincer attacking Connacht had been cut down, the western fleet on the Atlantic Ocean sailed in what was a suicidal mission, oblivious of what had just happened on the Shannon. The outcome was predictable, and this fleet disappeared into the west, never to return. Muirchertach had gone for broke and had lost. He was now ruling a defenceless kingdom, and Rory O'Connor was not willing to allow this chance to pass him by. That summer, in 1088, the people of Munster endured three devastating raids led by Rory's forces. The annals of the Four Masters illustrate just how thorough these raids were. In the line, "It is wonderful if he left any cattle or people." Wounded and defenceless, the scavengers of medieval Ireland, in the shape of Vikings from Dublin and Waterford, formed an alliance and began to circle around the wounded corpse of Muirchertach's kingdom. They would never have been able to overcome the kingdom when Thurloch had been at his height, but now Munster seemed vulnerable, and they struck. In a sign of just how far the power of the Vikings had declined, they were repelled after landing in Cork. However, this was little consolation for Muirchertach. Things were about to get dramatically worse. In the uncertainty after his father's death, the political situation was in a state of constant flux, and now he faced what must have seemed like a ghost from the past, when the Northern O'Neills emerged resurgent after 30 years of internal warfare. Next we'll see the O'Neills entered the fray. By 1088, while Munster was being annihilated, Donal MacLachlan had finally established control over the Conaill Éin and the wider Northern O'Neills in Western and Mid-Ulster. After a 30-year hiatus, while they had squabbled amongst themselves, the Northern O'Neill now began to look to enter the Game of Thrones that was tearing 11th century Ireland apart. And by late 1088, Donal MacLachlan saw his chance to intervene. After Rory O'Connor wore himself out by annihilating Muirchertach in Munster, Donal moved. He swept south into Connacht from Ulster, where Rory did not, indeed most likely could not, offer opposition. Instead, he submitted to Donal and then joined his hosting as it moved on towards Munster. By this stage, Munster was a wasteland, having been ravaged by Rory already three times in that summer. Nonetheless, Donal plundered his way through the north of the province, burning the city of Limerick before turning towards the O'Brien's fortress at Kincora. Teaching Muirchertach a stark lesson, he razed this fortress where the O'Briens had based themselves for years. While Muirchertach did not immediately submit to Donal, it was only a matter of time. His dreams of following in his father's footsteps would have to wait. He had been utterly vanquished. In the course of 1088, he had gambled everything on the massive naval invasion of Connacht. When this failed, he was defenceless, and everyone below him in the power structure queued up to have a go. Miraculously, he was able to maintain his power internally and even continued to have some control over Leinster. In 1089, he even attempted to gain vengeance on the King of Connacht, Rory O'Connor. This was extremely risky, as an attack on Rory would not only invoke the wrath of Rory, but also Donal McLaughlin, who was Rory's overlord. Nonetheless, Murchatuck pressed ahead with a plan slightly more modest than 1088. This time, it was simple. He would sail up the Shannon again and raid and loot settlements on the riverbank, undermining Rory's authority. This raid started well, indeed far better than the previous year's attempted attack. Murchatuck led his fleet unopposed as far as Loch Ree, a large lake in the Midlands. From there, they raided several monastic sites in Rory's kingdom, before turning south to sail back down to Munster. Murchatuck can only have been satisfied, having struck back at Rory and carried away a lot of loot and wealth, and he'd suffered few losses. However, as they sailed south, this satisfaction began to ebb away. As they arrived at the narrow channels around Inishirky, where Rory had blocked them the previous year, they now found the same situation again. Only a few months previously, they had been annihilated around this island, and there was no way they were going to allow this to happen again. Their only option, though, was to turn around and head back up the river towards Loch Ree. As Murchatuck sailed north, presumably hoping to draw Rory after him, his blood ran cold as he arrived at a shallow point used as a crossing at Athlone. This had been occupied by Donal Uamuil Shocknell, the son of the King of Meath. Murchatuck was now trapped in a hopeless position on a 20-kilometre section of the River Shannon between Athlone and Inishirky. There was no hope of escape, and Murchatuck had to surrender his fleet in the most humiliating fashion and submit to Donal Uamuil Shocknell. He was then escorted back to Munster under Donal's protection. This must have been utterly humiliating. Defeated and embarrassed, he arrived back in Munster, but now Murchatuck must have known he was in very serious trouble. He would not be able to even defend himself now that he had lost his fleet. Again he had gambled, incurring the wrath of Rory and his overlord Donal, and had lost. Just like the previous year, Donal and Rory now began sharpening their swords, assembling a large army, getting ready to strike back in vengeance. Since Murchatuck's fleet was annihilated, they could even sail down the Shannon unmolested now. Again they raided Thomond and destroyed the area of North Munster, taking everything of value. According to the annals of the Four Masters, it was so thorough so that they scarcely left a single head of cattle, so far as they penetrated, and besides carried off captives. Now one would think at this stage Murchatuck would give in, but given he lived in such a chaotic world, he did manage to hang on to power. While Murchatuck was struggling, many of his enemies were distracted by numerous smaller wars that raged across Ireland. The King of Meath, for example, raided territories in the North Midlands. Further south, the King of Leinster was locked in a ferocious battle ongoing with the O'Connor's Folly of the Midlands. That's a separate branch of the family to the O'Connors in Connacht. It was clear Ireland was just breaking out into a war of all against all, and in this scenario, Murchatuck was able to survive. However, by 1090, Donal MacLachlan was emerging as the most powerful king. In the early 1080s, he had survived what was a cauldron of violence in the internal struggles of Ulster. He had grown up through a civil war of the O'Neills and had shown himself the best strategist on the island. He had waited for Murchatuck and Rory to wear each other out, and then he had struck, establishing his power. By 1090, the only major force holding out against him was Murchatuck in Munster. But Donal had annihilated him on several occasions, and if he pressed the issue, there would be only one outcome. So at a royal meeting in 1090, attended by Murchatuck, Rory, the King of Connacht, Flann, the King of Meath, they all acknowledged Donal MacLachlan, the King of the North, as the most powerful king, while the annals of the Four Masters said the kings parted in peace and tranquility. There was no hope for the future. Donal either lacked the willingness or the interest or the power, maybe, to enforce peace across the island. As we shall see next time, Donal was heading up a very shaky house of cards, one that would quickly collapse into another round of war and violence. Until next time, Slán.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.